You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
So once again, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for being here in such large numbers. This is our second panel, and I think some of the themes that we'll be discussing will be quite similar to what we've talked about before, and that just shows you how enormous the problems are and how widespread they are across several regions. Now, Africans are younger than ever before. Africans are also more educated than ever before, but they're still struggling to find work. Youth unemployment in sub-Saharan Africa is estimated to be about 60%. Just think about that number during this conference. Now, this region's youth bulge can be a force for good. It can also turn into a crisis and a risk and a danger when there are no jobs. It's a threat to social cohesion and political stability. And jobless young people, as we know, are also more likely to be recruited by extremist groups. In other words, development and security cannot be separated. But there is good news as well from Africa, and we know that from the narrative of Africa Rising. And we at Friends of Europe believe very much in Africa's potential and its very bright future. And that's because of innovation and creativity. Cross-border digital initiatives such as Smart Africa and the One Network Africa area are new elements into this paradigm, and they give a lot of hope for the future. We're delighted to have with us today as our keynote speaker, Mr. Alexander De Croo. We know he's Belgian Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Development Cooperation and the Digital Agenda. Mr. De Croo has agreed to give the keynote speech, but let me first also introduce other members of the panel. Dan Owendo, Dan, founder and chairman of Invest Capital, which focuses on financing for SMEs across East Africa. He's also managing director of Home Africa, which is a property development company. He's come here all the way from Nairobi, and Dan, we're really grateful for your presence here. Korn Virwaka, managing director for Africa and the European External Action Service, at the European External Action Service. Thank you very much, Korn, for walking all this way here, I hope. Heike Rutgers, head of division for development and impact finance at the European Investment Bank, which has 50 years of experience of working in Africa. And we'll be joined very soon, I hope, by Rotimi Olawale, who is chairman of the Africa Youth Panel, which brings together youth leaders from all over Africa. We're talking about young people. We talked about it this morning, and we're going to continue to do so later this morning. So, Minister, the floor is yours. I'll make room for you.
Thank you. Good morning. Congratulations to all of you in getting here. It's not been easy this morning in Brussels, and if the theme of the discussion here is about making sure that the potential of youth is being harnessed, I guess in Europe and especially in Belgium you could have the same discussion if this is not one generation just blocking the other in harnessing the opportunity that is here. I'm really happy with the theme of this discussion, because what struck me over the last 1 year and a half, I've been in this domain for almost a year and a half now, is that in the development world there is a gigantic amount of good intentions. I have not seen any place in society that is not more entrenched with good intentions. But that abundance of good intentions also very often leads to a lot of talking. A lot of talking is good, but at some point the talking needs to move into doing something, needs to move into action. And one of the worrying things is that a lot of the talking about development and about the perspective of the world, and especially related to Africa, is actually quite negative. If you would ask in a room, and not going to do it here because you might be more informed than the average room, but if you ask the question, is the world going in the right direction or in the wrong direction? In general, you get 80% of the room that is saying the world is definitely going in the wrong direction, which is actually not the case if you look at the numbers. If you look at the numbers, over the last 10 years, worldwide, 800 million people have been lifted outside of extreme poverty. Humanity has never done this before. Never before have we ever pushed so many people outside of extreme poverty. If you look at other metrics, child mortality has over the last 20 years been divided by two. 2.2 billion people have gotten access to drinking water, to clean water, over the last 25 years. And mother mortality also has been divided by two over the last 15 years. So the trend is overly positive. Now, the question is, are these positive results, first of all, are they to be generalized? This is the first mistake I make, of course. This is a general mistake or trick that a lot of politicians use, is of course I talk in averages. And talking in averages has one problem, is that, well, on average, we're improving, but there is parts of the world where this is not happening. And this is obviously true. You see a convergence in the world, and this is a good thing, but mostly you could say that in sub-Saharan Africa and some other places, sometimes in Southeast Asia, you do not see this progress. Second element is, where is this coming from? I mean, those positive numbers, those 800 million people that we lifted out of poverty, is this thanks to the classic definition of development cooperation? Unfortunately not. Not at all. The people we lifted out of poverty, it's mostly in India, in China, in Brazil, and some smaller countries. How do you do that? We do that through commerce, trade, investment, open societies, and so on. And this has been the main driver of sustainably lifting people outside of poverty. Now, the whole question is, could you replicate this in Africa and in sub-Saharan Africa? I think there is no doubt you could. But the biggest mistake we could make, and I guess the panel will address that, is to consider Africa as just one homogeneous place in the world where everything is the same for all African countries. Obviously, the situation, economic situation, is very different in Ukraine than it is in Belgium. That would be exactly the same as considering the situation in Mali as exactly the same as the one in Malawi. These are very, very different circumstances. Still, there is a lot of optimism, and there was made reference to Africa Rising, and I thought this was a milestone in the discussion. There has after that been some nuancing to that, but just addressing a few elements that make me optimistic. And I actually going to structure it around some of the questions that are going to be asked to the panel. So this is making your life easier, because I'm already giving some hints. And I'll start with the third question. And the third question says, what is being done to encourage innovators and entrepreneurs to develop new transformational technologies, including growth in areas such as telecommunications, mobile bankings, and payment systems? This is a very important topic, and you might know that I'm Minister of Development, but also Minister of Digital Agenda, which seems to be a very odd combination, which I thought too when I started doing this. But actually, it's a very good combination, because if you look in the development world today, technology is really the main vector for growth. And you see that today, the edge of development in some domains, let's think about mobile payments, let's think about distant healthcare, the edge of development is not in the Western world. The edge of development today is in Kenya, is in Bangladesh, is in Tanzania, is in South Africa, and so on. And I think this is the most inspiring news that we've ever heard. Because to be fair, up to now, globalization has been, I would say, a bit of a myth. I mean, globalization was the Western world developed it and the rest of the world was consuming it. This is not globalization in the true sense. Today, this is happening. Today, we are really going into the direction of a multipolar world, a world where you see the creation of technology and of value added being taking place in all places, in different places all over the world. And I think this is a great thing. Now, where did this come from? Well, it came from one very simple thing, namely economic opportunity. And economic opportunity attracts investments and attracts entrepreneurs. And investors and entrepreneurs will come for one good reason, and that one good reason is profit. And profit is good, also in development. Now, I do not see you start shouting. I often say that also in rooms with NGOs and so on, and there the reaction is often a bit less silent. But if you truly believe in sustainable development, and I really believe in it, and I think the SDGs are a really good framework, there is no development, there is no economic activity that will be sustainable if there's no profit at some point. And the investments we see in sub-Saharan Africa today, for example, in mobile networks, the great thing is this is not state investments. These are all private investments. And that is a great thing because it shows that, first of all, there is potential, but secondly, that the framework and the stability is there to do these investments that have payback times of 10 to 15 years. So should governments invest in this themselves? No, definitely not. Should they create the stability to enable that? Yes, definitely they should. And I think we see a lot of places where this is taking place today. Second element is, I think the first question that is going to be asked, is there enough job creation to help quell the stream of migrants and the radicalization that you often see? I think that migration and radicalization are very complex topics, and even in Belgium, I think we're really beginning to start to understand what the real drivers are. Still, there's enough studies that are actually quite clear. There is a study done on Boko Haram by the U.S. Institute of Peace that clearly identifies that there are two elements that make people vulnerable. One of them is lack of opportunity, and especially lack of economic opportunity, and the second one is insecurity and civil wars. My feeling has always been that if you look at the young population, and most of the sub-Saharan African countries have a very, very young population, is that young people are looking for opportunities to build their society, to be a co-builder to their society. And up to now, too often, the only way to be a co-builder of society was through politics or through civil service. And I think this is one way of doing it. But another way of doing it is giving people the opportunity to be an entrepreneur, to start a business, to be active in NGOs and in civil society. You need trust as a government to give that room. And too often, that trust is not given, because very often a strong middle class, a strong economic class, is seen as a threat to a government. I think that threat needs to be there. And this is the case, and this should be the case in Belgium, it should be the case in Europe, it should be the case in any country. Any ruling class, any government, any president needs a counterbalance. And a counterbalance is someone who can from time to time say, no, I think you're wrong, I think you're not serving the general interest, I think there are other priorities that need to be set. And that counterbalance can be religion, it can be a middle class, it can be entrepreneurs, but you need some trust to create that space. I think this is the main thing that we should be pushing for, is creating a space where a young population can co-build to society and is not always looking to government to achieve that. Last question that I would like to address, and then really the floor is up to the panel. Is there enough effort done to create employment in rural and in urban areas in Africa today? I think, first of all, coming back to a comment I made in the beginning, there is a gigantic heterogeneity in Africa today. the mostly rural development, let's say in Burundi or in Niger, is very, very different than the urban development that you would see in Congo Brazzaville or in the DRC or in South Africa. I think there is one domain in which we haven't really invested a lot, and you could even say that this is the case in the Western world, is in the science of building and managing cities. No one really knows how to do that. And that is because up to now, cities have grown organically and actually on a quite slow pace. The number of 1 million inhabitants cities in Africa is exploding. I think if I remember, it's 70 to 80 1 million inhabitant cities that you already have today. And they are growing at a very different pace than what we have seen today. They are growing organically, you could say it in a nice way. They are growing chaotically, if you would say it in a more dramatic way. And there is an opportunity there today to apply some science, to apply some knowledge to it, and to really see how you should be doing it. Cities should be a place of creativity, should be a place of opportunity, not a place of crime and of poverty that it is actually very often today. But if you want job creation to take place, and as I said before, investment and trade are key components. And when we talk about trade, too often, when we talk about trade in the African context, we always limit that to trade with the rest of the world. Trade with Europe, trade with the United States. Now, this is nice, but this is not the key one for me. The key one is trade in the region. And that is the big problem today. Trade in the region is almost not taking place. It is not taking place often due to conflicts, but especially it is not taking place because there is a complete lack of infrastructure. If you really want to have a development in Africa, which is a development that is not too dependent on mineral resources, but it is more dependent on agriculture, on small business, on small manufacturing, the key thing you need is making sure that trade within the region can take place. Infrastructure is an element in that. Regional integration is an element in that as well. And there I think that a country as Belgium historically has good experience and has experience to share. You might know that the over-grandfather of the European Union, there's no doubt that it is the Benelux, and that small open countries such as Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Belgium has always been at the forefront of regional integration that has led to an enormous creation of wealth, first in the Benelux and then, you could say, in the 28 European countries. That capacity building, that experience sharing, I think it is something that we should be putting much more effort in than the more classical view of development cooperation that we have always looked at. I use the word development cooperation, and I prefer development cooperation over development aid. Development aid is a very ancient paternalistic view in my perspective. I think development cooperation, it still raises my hairs a little bit, because development cooperation, in my view, also has a certain paternalistic element in it. It says that we need to cooperate with each other because you need to cooperate with me. I think that's completely wrong. I think this whole north-south view is completely dated. Can we today say that the problems are in the south and that the solutions are in the north? I think it's fair to say that we have our share of problems, and I think it's very fair to say that we don't always have the good answers to some of the problems that we have. And this is the thing that the Sustainable Development Goals have changed. Sustainable Development Goals basically say we are all countries in development. There's no developing countries and there's no developed countries. I mean, how arrogant would it be to say that we are developed? What does that mean? Does that mean that we are at the end of development? I think this is completely, completely wrong. And so going from development aid to development cooperation, the real terminology to use is international development. And international development, from my perspective, is the right one. International development says that international relationships are good and that they are to the benefits of the ones who are part of it. But that is really on a basis of equality and is completely on a basis of seeing the benefits and making sure that the benefits are reaped for everyone. I hope you understand that I'm an optimist, that I'm very positive about the perspective of development throughout the world and especially in Africa. But up to now, if we are fair, it's mostly in newspaper articles and it's mostly in debates such as this. So I'm a big fan of debates as this one, but something needs to happen after debates. So I hope you enjoy the debates, but I hope you especially get to action afterwards. Thanks a lot.
Minister, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I know you have to leave. You've done your homework and you've set us a nice task for the future as well. Thank you very much indeed. So I think a very insightful intervention by Mr. De Croo, talking about technology and growth, about creativity, about entrepreneurship, and many other issues. And I think that's quite refreshing, actually, to hear a young minister talk of youth in Africa as well. So many similarities with the discussion we had this morning as well. I'm going to jump in here with you, Dan. Entrepreneurship. You yourself are an entrepreneur. You've made it, I guess, facing several challenges. Tell us a little bit about your own struggle with this and whether you think that this, you know, given the youth unemployment issues that are out there in Africa that we've talked about, whether that entrepreneurship spirit is there and can be cultivated. It's on. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I think that the subject matter of youth employment in Africa is so significant that it should be part and parcel of all discussions that happen anywhere, not just in the Western world, but also in Africa. My own journey on entrepreneurship was very difficult initially. I started out as an entrepreneur when I was 15, 16 years old. And one of the biggest challenges there was obviously access to capital. And particularly when you're looking for capital to build a small business, in an African setting is very, very difficult because all the private equity players, all the venture capital players that possibly come from Europe and from America and from other places to come and set up shop in Kenya or in other parts of Africa will tell you that, you know, if a deal is not more than $250,000 or $500,000, they are not really interested. And I could understand where they're coming from because it's expensive to invest in businesses, particularly when you're investing low amounts of money. The other challenge is that government itself does not have policies that are structured around how to help young budding entrepreneurs. For example, you know, you get a business to supply product or services to the government, and this is generally across the African continent. And once you issue your invoice, they'll take 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, sometimes more, to pay you. And there you are, you're a starting entrepreneur, you just have very limited capital, and you have to keep waiting for 90 days or 120 days to be paid by government. That becomes impossible for you to continue with that process. I think the other thing is that when you look at the African continent, we've talked about the trade, intra-Africa trade, and that's a big problem in our markets. And so if that's a problem that you have seen from that light, you can imagine a young budding entrepreneur who has a product or service to sell. They basically have no access to market. And as the deputy minister said, infrastructure, and not just hard infrastructure, we are talking about roads and rail and so on. We're also talking about soft infrastructure, where we're talking licenses, we are talking payment terms and things like that, makes it impossible for young entrepreneurs to do anything. And so part of the process that we must engage in is to make sure that government sees those limitations and creates modalities and policies that support how entrepreneurs start and grow. One of the things that has happened in Kenya, which I think is fantastic, and I've seen that happening in South Africa as well, the government has come up with a fund that is meant to help entrepreneurs to access cash easily, to be able to build their businesses, but also to provide some capacity building for them to build the businesses they're in. Now, I find that the problem is that the resources applied to that kind of an initiative is so low. We're talking about $10 million. Now, $10 million in a population of 42 million people, 44 million people, is nothing. But it's an initiative that has started. Now, if you think about part of a partnership that I think should come from friends like Europeans and Americans and so on, this is part of a process that I think they should get involved in and say, look, we can match you $10 million by another $10 million to help support youth employment and youth creation of businesses across the African continent. I know that, you know, the fund that has been created out of South Africa is much bigger, and so it's supporting many more businesses, creation and development of those businesses. And so I feel that there are initiatives that are starting. They're still too small because of resources, but they are a step in the right direction. And I think that as some of the challenges come up from the entrepreneurs themselves, those challenges then get met by solutions that are being created internally as opposed to solutions that are being created out of the country. So if you're talking about laws related to payment terms, as the business of an entrepreneur starts, young entrepreneur, youth entrepreneur starts, that challenge is then presented to government as a challenge for him to proceed growing the business. And so the government is forced to start thinking about policies around that area. And I've seen that happening in our country. I find that as those challenges come up in the light, then government is forced to look at those challenges and provide solutions around them. And I find that during my time of starting, the challenges that I had are a little softer now for the younger entrepreneurs today, because government has started taking into consideration some of the challenges and putting together solutions around those challenges.
But Dan, you talk about challenges, maybe they're a bit softer and less harsh than they were, but they're still there. How do you engage as a young-ish entrepreneur, how do you engage with a government that has so many other priorities, including security, on its table?
We actually don't have necessarily a direct channel through which you engage government. But I have found that as you meet, through networks of this nature, as you meet lawmakers, as you meet ministers or cabinet secretaries, you are able to present your case, because I've done that in my own case. You're able to present your case and you're able to push for support around rallying through an idea that you might have that could help the bigger society. Now, that's one. Two, we have a few institutions in Kenya. For example, we have one called Financial Sector Deepening Fund, which was created by the DFID. Mm-hmm. And these people, agency, what they do is that they collate information from the market about some of the challenges that entrepreneurs faced as they are starting out. And so through networks into this kind of organization, I'm able to then present my case, and they can take it up as an institution and present it to the various arms of government to create support for it.
And I guess media pressure, media also helps perhaps by spotlighting these issues. Heike, you've just heard from Dan about the initiatives that exist, but the challenges that are there as well. The EIB is developing a new approach towards Africa, I believe. Will these kinds of problems, obstacles be part of your remit?
Yes, indeed. We have been starting to look at ways how to do things differently and scale up our interventions, find other partners, and also, to increase the impact on the ground we want to achieve. And the first step was in creating in the in our finance, in our funds available, and a so-called impact financing envelope, which allows us to take a higher level of risk for a higher development impact. So to have the appropriate sources of funding. And then also, of course, discussing with our partners, in particular, of course, with the European Commission on how to make best use of the blending instruments which are available in order to come up with a catalytic financing. Now, what we wanted to do, as we consider ourselves now already for more than 50 years in the business of improving the livelihoods of people on the ground in Africa, we thought, okay, what is actually, compared to what we have been doing now, if we just scale this up, this is not enough. And I went to Kenya several times, and I had a lot of discussions with young entrepreneurs or those who had a lot of very interesting ideas, but who were exactly facing these constraints, finding a place where to for example, elaborate a prototype for a new invention, finding the first capital really to start, finding other partners. And so we were thinking on how we can really find a solution and do that at scale in order to provide a solution for that. And we are currently working indeed on an initiative which is supposed to be African-wide, together with the African Development Bank, and which will be called Boost Africa, and which we intend to launch later this year, and which is supposed to provide a combination of an investment vehicle, which will be able to provide financing to an area in the value chain of entrepreneurship, where for the time being what we see on the ground, there is only little foundation money available, all friends and families who help a little bit, these coming up entrepreneurs who have a lot of innovative ideas. So to help in, to provide finance in that space. And what is very encouraging is actually when we did a mapping exercise across Africa is that we see a lot of initiatives in this area. Yeah. Business angel funds, accelerators, incubators, seed funds who really want to push this idea. And of course, a lot of innovative ideas on the ground. And when I talk about innovation, I mean, people think immediately about technology and so on. But innovation, we have defined it in a large sense because we see also a lot of innovative business models which are worth pursuing. And so to combine this investment vehicle, which will then invest in these particular players in the ecosystem, to combine that also with serious capacity building and also creating a knowledge and innovation lab where people can share knowledge and also create synergies and where there can be a cross-fertilization. The idea is also to foster and enhance a matching process between European and other external investors and local investors. We see a lot in our discussions with European companies that a lot of European companies, small and medium enterprises, are very interested in Africa, but of course they are afraid to take the first step and get on the ground. The big ones, they are all there. I mean, if you go to Kenya, you find the Philips of this world, you find Google, you find all the big ones. But in order to help the small and medium ones, we also need to have to create some kind of a soft landing place where we can help them to work together. Because what you see all over in the world, entrepreneurs who come together, they can then work together and they find a profitable investment.
Mm. Can I just ask you one follow-up question? These innovative business models that you've referred to, can you just give us a little bit of a clarification on what you're referring to?
Yes, I can give a very basic example, which we have financed through a social impact investment fund, which is working and operating in Eastern Africa, and which has so developed and invested in a company called Synergy. I'm sure, Dan, you know them. And who have developed a system of dry toilets for the slums in Nairobi. Right. And which is working on a franchising system, and so really providing toilets in the slums where nobody can come with a car, right, and which is really adapted to local circumstances. And in the meantime, I mean, this company has grown enormously, has received small seed funding in the beginning, and over time has grown and has, as such, now 700 different entrepreneurs who are running these toilets. It seems probably an idea which nobody here would even think about, but that's what innovation is about. You find in under situations of local constraints, also with a weak infrastructure, you find very innovative ideas in Africa which we wouldn't come up with even.
No, absolutely. And I think that's what Alexander De Croo was referring to when he said globalization now means creativity in all parts of the world. Thank you very much, Heike. I'm sure there'll be questions from the floor for you. Cohen, listening to the minister and now our two panelists as well, the European Union has had kind of a traditional approach to Africa up to now. You know, it's been very much donor-beneficiary approach, but things are changing, things are changing. Africa's changing, Europe is changing. Can you outline for us a little bit your new sort of vision for this relationship, for this new Africa?
Thank you very much. Things are changing, but they have to change even more because Africa is changing and in one way or another, Europe is changing as well. And maybe that's the first point I want to make on the African side. This is definitely a continent on the move. And more than any other continent, I think Africa is changing. And transformation, change, includes also fragility, democratic change, economic transitions, and that means that we need to be take care that we can sustain and support change what is happening. The demographic aspect of it, I think, is an important one in our view because it's definitely positive, it's a dividend, it's cheap labor, but it also, of course, is a point of fragility because you need to create the jobs. And I think we don't sufficiently grasp what it means to have a population, and more than half of your population is younger than 20 years old, meaning a population in Rwanda that is born after the genocide, in South Africa, population half of the population born after the end of apartheid. And it's not only the jobs, but it's also the, let's say, the anthropological change and the half of your population that has a different framework than the traditional one in your country. And when you look, and it was mentioned, the rural and urbanization, so there's a lot of elements that need to be taken care of. And when the global economy is slowing down, when I think the continent realizes that it is not so easy to industrialize, to create the jobs, to perform this agricultural transformation, these are really issues, not only opportunity, but also of concern. And that means for us, European Union, to focus on two tasks, that is continuing supporting stability, and we are extremely heavily engaged in the Sahel, in the Horn, in Nigeria with Boko Haram and so on, but also creating the economic growth and jobs. The second point is to clearly say that we see a sense of urgency. You all read the press, the migration aspect of our relationship with the continent is now the one that is really hitting the headlines. And all the horrible pictures we see of the Mediterranean support, of course, this. And we need really to, it's a message to us, but also, I think, to Africa. And that's what we discussed with Africa in Valletta last year. This is a shared responsibility. Shared responsibility, but also shared interest. And I think that's a clear opportunity for Europe and Africa to say, migration is a shared responsibility. We have a shared interest in managing this. Terrorism, again, an issue where Africa and Europe come together, issues where we have to work together. And that means that we have to, as I've been said by the minister, but also by the two other speakers, we have to scale up. We have to do differently. We have to do more and really to do it on a different level. We have been putting much more economic growth and job creation in the center of our partnership. I think the agenda for change was very much already focusing on this, but we need to do better. We are looking ahead at the EU-Africa Summit next year in Africa, 2017. We are also discussing, that's the more strategic level, post-Cotonou, how to shape our long-term relations with the continent on a new footing, and all these aspects need to be much more in the center. But job creation, of course, is not just, let's say, giving resources to entrepreneurs, how important it is, giving them access to capital. It's also what you said, regional integration. We are about to finalize economic partnership agreements. They have been hugely criticized in the past, but we think this should be in the center of a new approach towards, let's say, job creation, region integration, a critical part of economic diplomacy towards the continent, which we haven't done so far in the past. Private sector should be part of that. It's bringing together, it's much more about loans than about grants. It's bringing together the private development banks, the private banks, the development banks, EIB, EBRDB, why not sovereign bonds? What can we do on that? Credit agencies supporting to invest in more in Africa. So this is now really in the center of the way we are looking at Africa.
So the thing is, in the earlier session, Ahmed Galal said it's about bad economics, which you've mentioned, but also about bad politics. Mm. And that's what I want to ask you. The question of governance, good governance or not. I mean, how central is it to Africa's future, whether it's good or bad, depends on governance, right?
But governance says it all.
Doing on that is what I mean
to say. Yeah, no, and that's where you need to, let's say, country by country, and to see what can be improved. First of all, I think what you have to say is that governance has hugely improved on the continent. And this is, the minister said it, it's not one continent. You have to look at country by country. But I think there is a realization at continental level that there need to be more inclusive governance. I think the inclusivity is important because it makes societies much more resilient. It creates the opportunities for the people to stay at home. So it's good when we look at migration, which of course we look, and I think I have to say it here, very much from a European perspective, migrants coming to Europe, but it is something that is very natural on the African continent and very much promoted at the freedom, free movement of labor on the continent. But this the inclusivity of governance, to come back to that, be it political, be it economic, and I think you can't separate both, it's very much linked to the middle class building up, the minister also referred to, remains something critical. And it is, by the way, when we talk about investment, the shared interest we have that more European companies invest in Africa, they need the same reassurance and strong business climate as African entrepreneurs need. So there's no difference. And if we can invest more, the shared interest is that this would also contribute to growth in Europe. So there's a completely good win-win situation to build upon.
And so that's the top priority, I guess, for the next EU-Africa summit next year. Mm. Rotimi, I want to come back to this issue that Cohen has raised also and others about people, young people leaving Africa, lack of jobs, lack of a future, lack of trust in governments. For your Africa Youth Panel, how important is this issue of, you know, lack of future jobs, hope at home?
I think to contextualize some of the challenges faced by young people in several African countries, I'd use a couple of examples.
A bit more closer, yeah.
In Nigeria, if you want to rent a shop in Abuja or Lagos, the owner of the property would demand that you pay a one-year rent ahead at the minimum. In Lagos and Abuja specifically, you have to pay 2 years' rent ahead to rent a shop. So for a small scale entrepreneur, that's difficult. For you to get a loan, it's almost impossible for you to get a loan from a bank. You have to fall on friends and families, in immediate families to raise money. And so these are specific challenges that young people face in setting up businesses. To register a company in Nigeria as a young person, it takes you a minimum of 18 days to register a company. And that process can even be longer if you decide not to pay, incentivize the officers involved. So you go and apply to have your business registered. The name is declined. You don't know the reason. You put in another application. You wait a couple of days, it's declined. You can be on that process for 30, 40 days, and your business is delayed. And it's also costs to you. So these are specific challenges that young people face across the continent. I'm happy my colleague mentioned some good practices that we're beginning to see. In countries like Kenya, Rwanda, Zambia, Nigeria, and South Africa, we have a fund that has been set up by government to encourage entrepreneurs, and not only funding, to provide mentorship. In Nigeria, there's an initiative that was launched called the Youth Enterprise with Innovation, called YouWin, which is a fund set up by government to the tune of $100 million that provides between $10,000 to $20,000 per entrepreneur, which encourages young people to create businesses in agriculture, in the fashion industry, in the services industry. Again, on the ease of doing business, we're seeing some emerging countries who are beginning to reform the ease of doing business to ensure that opportunities are available for young people. In countries like Rwanda, to register a business is now 24 to 48 hours, and this can be done online. Nigeria is also looking at such examples. In countries like Kenya, they've moved up 20 steps on the ease of doing business ranking of the World Bank. And so these are emerging examples that we're beginning to see on the continent. When you talk about unemployment on the continent, there are different strata. You have people who are highly educated who have no jobs. You have people who are not educated and who don't have jobs. When you talk about the problem of Boko Haram in the northern part of Nigeria, this is mainly people who are uneducated. The northeastern part of Nigeria is the least educated part of Nigeria. They have no education, no formal education. They have no skills, and of course, they have no jobs. So the strategy to deal with this kind of situation will be completely different to those who are highly skilled, are highly educated, and have jobs. Africans are beginning to read a lot. I have friends who have 2 degrees, several masters, and who don't have a job. I have friends who have 2 degrees, who are driving taxis, who are doing cleaning for companies in order to find a living. Many of them are frustrated. They want to leave the continent. They want to take an illegal route into Europe. They want to migrate because the field, this is a land of opportunity, and it's better for them to sell all they have to migrate here. And interestingly, it's not even cheap for them to come to Europe. For those who are going through the illegal route through the Sahel to Libya, it costs, I was in Banjul a couple of weeks back and I was discussing with young people, it costs them an average of 5,000 euros to 6,000 euros. And sometimes the entire family has to contribute this money to send one person to go on this dangerous journey to Europe in search of opportunities.
Have you discussed, recipes for remedies for this? I mean, do you, in your discussions with your members of your panel, have any innovative ideas about how to deal with this, extremism and also lack of jobs? Any new ideas that have come up that we could benefit from?
I think we're beginning to see emerging ideas. One of such is that there's a new wave of a higher level of demand for accountability on the continent. You've seen that in South Africa recently where there's this huge protest by university students on the fees must fall. They said tuition fees in university are too expensive. The average person in South Africa cannot afford it, and they were demanding government to reduce such fees. You've seen it in Burkina Faso when the president attempted to change the constitution and to remain in power. Young people said enough is enough. You've seen it in Kenya. You've seen it in Nigeria. There's a huge and a greater demand for accountability. You have a greater number of young people who are educated. You have a greater number of young people who have access to smartphones and the internet, and who can use such tools to organize and to debate and discuss these issues, and to write blogs and to do YouTube videos and to go on radio shows and programs. And so this greater demand for accountability is putting strain on government. In Nigeria, there's a good initiative called Budget, which takes budget information from government and convert it into infographics for young people to understand. And so 3 years ago, when the government published their budgets, they put it on a website. They thought no one was going to look at it. Budget took this information and began to share on social media. And so young people were like, oh, government is going to spend $10 million for the presidential house only for feeding. and they began to ask questions. We don't have food. Why will you spend this amount of money on feeding in a government house? And so this is beginning to put pressure on government. You saw a demand in Kenya where teachers were asking for more pay, and they went on strike, whereas they said, how can the MPs be earning higher pay and we teachers are not paid well? So this is one mix. The other mix is also we are seeing a rise of innovation, especially around technology. And Kenya and Nigeria has this elderly competition when it comes to tech innovation. Nigeria is always looking at Kenya, and Kenya is always looking at Nigeria when it comes to tech innovation. We've seen good practices come out of Kenya, like the M-Pesa, mobile money transfer, which has been widely used across the continent and actually across outside the continent. In Nigeria, we're seeing innovation around the music and fashion industry. Yeah. Nigeria's movie industry is being watched across the continent. It's hugely popular. Nigeria's music stars are hugely popular across the continent. And these are primarily young people who are recording and shooting videos in their backyard, putting it on YouTube and hitting 2 million views and becoming instant stars and millionaires overnight.
Right. So the power of social media, if the national media is muzzled, and also virtuous competition for being the best in town or best on the continent. So thank you very much. Happy now to open the floor to questions. Could I see a show of hands to see how many people are interested in coming in at this point and engaging with our panelists on all the different issues that have been raised? I see 2, 3. Good. Let's go there first. Khaled, Fabio.
John Murray from South Africa. I'm previously a diplomat, these days a consultant advisor on public affairs. What's very important is creating jobs for youth in Africa. That is one of the themes that's coming out of here, and it should be one of the goals for security in Africa and a peaceful, stable future, as well as regional integration. And I'm hoping that the EPAs can be needed a platform, as Kun said earlier. I'm wondering if perhaps, Kun, I remember I spoke to you 9 years ago about Inga Dam and the need perhaps for some kind of a platform to focus a collection of stakeholders, to focus a coordinated stakeholder attention on Inga, for example, rollout. But now looking at the EPAs, I'm wondering if the European Union at this point in time is already thinking of some vehicles that would facilitate joint venture partners coming in from the EU into Africa using perhaps facilities like the Chaisson facility from the past with tax write-offs and incentives to get them to plug in to create jobs, particularly for youth, that can perhaps be targeted using some kind of a stakeholder platform that links not only to the EPAs but also to key projects such as transport corridors and Inga. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll take a couple of questions and then turn to you. Here, please. Yes, Andrew. Andrew, didn't you have your hand up? Did you have your hand up?
Hi, my name is Andrew Ginastet. I'm professor at the Martin Buber University, and my question is going to be a radical question because you are talking about many symptoms of the system of violence, symptoms which lead into problems and difficulties which then are depicted on the economic level. And my question is the same very often in these conferences. What are you all together doing to prevent violence disrupting your societies? What is your prevention scheme?
Thank you. And the gentleman over there, please. And Gert Laporte, I'm going to ask you to ask a question or give a few comments as well, because if there's one person who knows a lot about what we're talking about, it's you. So no free lunch.
Merci, Madame la Moderatrice. Je suis le docteur Maxime Emania.
Maxime Emania. I'm in charge of the private sector and in investments at the Secretariat of the Africa, Caribbean, and Pacific States. And it is the very first time I have the opportunity to attend this type of conference, and I'm delighted to have taken part in the very first debate, and I would like to create a linkage with the debate we are having right now. I think that we need to get rid of pessimism or a pessimistic approach about Africa, because most of the time we do raise all the problems about Africa, and Africa has problems, as it is the case almost everywhere else. But in the focus we need to have, I think it would be interesting to focus on what's going on quite well in terms of investment at the level of the private sector, etc. And the experience in Rwanda or other countries, for example, would have been a good opportunity to have a different approach with the debate, to have a more positive approach at the level of this debate. It might be interesting to look at Rwanda and see the type of devices they put in place with a view to create a set of good practice and be a source of hope. And we have a delegation from the Caribbean, which is supposed to go to Rwanda with a view to take advantage of the knowledge they gained.
Oui, madame,
do you have a second point?
Okay. Yeah. La question que je...
And the first point I raised is about consistency, political consistency, I would say. And we have seen in the debate that we did refer to the primacy of the market with the structural changes. We did refer to the regional integration with the different partnership systems which were supposed to be put in place. And we have seen the frame, the political frame, which should have been put in place.
Être plus précise et plus bref, parce que je dois tourner vers le panel.
Est-ce
que vous avez une autre question?
Ma question est simple. Comment est-ce que...
My question is quite simple. How is it possible for us to be fully consistent between the talk and the actions and activities we do implement? So it's a matter of consistency.
Make a few comments, but you'll have to be brief as well.
It was not my intention to take the floor, but since I'm asked to do so, Geert Laporte, ECDPM, we work on Europe-Africa relations. I have one short question. We have had a lot of discussions about the big changes in Africa, the societal dynamics of change that should be supported, youth, women, private sector. What is it that the European Union could do better after all these years of having strong relations with Africa? It's a question for Koen.
Yes, I think also perhaps for all of us here, what could we do better, Europe, but also what could Africa do better? So, Dan, let's start with you first, and then I'll go to Koen. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll just make a few comments on some of the questions that have been raised. I think the first question related to JV partnerships, I think is very, very, very important. I believe that whereas solutions are coming from the African continent, those solutions just need to be supported. And so talking about JV partnerships, I think is critical, that you can come and find an existing startup, whether it's in technology or other areas, that is making an effort to create employment, making an effort to make a profit, and therefore build a sustainable business, and therefore partner with that sort of entity. I think it's important because usually the partnership goes through either a local bank or goes through a venture capital fund or a private equity fund. Now, these people who manage your funds out there first have no idea and understanding about the local market. And so they are in that market because they have seen an opportunity to build and manage a PE fund or a venture capital fund, but they do not have the local knowledge. Secondly, those JVs must be created with sufficient allowance to invest in smaller companies. The youth will not develop big companies. They will start and then grow those companies. You must then engage at a JV partnership at that low level to be able to then create the capacity for them. The other thing that is important is just the experience of these young entrepreneurs. They don't have the experience. They might have the knowledge and education about how to run businesses, but your support as an older, much more experienced business person would be very important for them. So the mentorship, the capacity building that comes from you to support their business is also critical. And I think that's something that we as an institution needs to find a way to encourage. The other question is about what is it that we are doing individually. I'll give you two things that I personally am doing. When I retired from Investor Capital last year, I was going to be an angel investor because we don't have sufficient angel investors in our market. One, we don't know how to do it. Secondly, the resources are also limited to a large extent. And so the JV partnerships also comes through in that level that I could be a local angel investor, but in partnership with other angel investors that come from Europe to support the entrepreneurship and the job creation that is being done in our local market. And so as an angel investor and as someone who encourages angel investing in our markets, there is a linkage that we can help to support some of the local partnership. The question on Rwanda is a very simple one, governance. In a country where governance is not just talked about, but executed, you get positive results. That's what we see in Rwanda. That's what we see in other countries that are getting pressure and accountability to create a proper governance structure. It happens not just in governments, but in companies as well. When you have proper governance, you have a future. And I think that's what I want to ask
you a follow-up. You said, you know, come to Africa and find an entity, an organization you could work with. But where does one have an inventory or a mapping of these different, where does one find them? How does one find them?
Just like if I come to anywhere in Europe, I will find chambers of commerce that are working. I'll find organizational associations that are working or business associations that are working that create the networks. It's the same thing in Africa. We have working chambers of commerce. We have business associations that are working and that give an immediate network opportunity for, you know, not just local but international players as well.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Kuhn?
First of all, the second question I didn't get really, the man with the hat.
It was a prevention of violence, the focus on prevention rather than countering once it's done.
Ah, okay. Good. Let me then pick up some of the elements. First of all, on the South African, yes, we have been working hard on INGA, and I'm sure the European Investment Bank can tell you a story on this as well. And it should remain on our plate, but of course, the political conditions are less favorable.
Can you explain this thing very quickly for people who don't know?
But INGA is a huge and potentially fantastic project of hydroelectricity in the DRC. It could be a fantastic project on climate change with not only a continental importance, but certainly also even a global importance. But it's also a very complex one to bring together the different financial stakeholders, investors, to have a clarity on what you will do with the electricity produced, whether it's for export or for the DRC itself. All that can be solved, but I think you need a more stable environment before you can step into this very important investments. But it is at a lower scale, of course, what we want to do when we roll out the economic partnership agreements in the different countries. And you talked about stakeholder platforms where we should be able to bring in the private sector, the European private sector already present in your countries, to sit down with the local private sector, to sit down with the local authorities, to see how together we can contribute to a better business environment, but also assist you in putting in place the right mechanisms for region integration. The customs administration, there has been talk about the soft and the hard infrastructure you need for region integration. What can we do to help you to assist in putting in place the missing links in that? And that's exactly what we aim to do. On the conflict prevention, of course, we are there. It is maybe... That's the difficulty of conflict prevention is that it is less visible than let's say when conflict or crisis breaks out. But what we are doing, helping, assisting Africa to keep peace in Somalia, to prepare for the elections, is also a perfect illustration of conflict prevention. Of course, what we do in Nigeria, it's not exactly conflict prevention, but in a way, it is certainly assisting not only Nigeria, but all the countries in the region to prevent the spread of Boko Haram, similarly in the Sahel, with our strong work to keep countries like Niger, countries like Burkina Faso, which are about to collapse because of the multiple threats they are facing, and that's pure conflict prevention, to support these countries to stay afloat with budget support, with security support, with development support, with support to the vulnerable communities that are prone to extremism or migration. On Rwanda, I think Dan already replied, but even, and I think that's the point of Rwanda as well, even if you work on your domestic governance, countries like Rwanda, who are completely isolated at the middle of the continent, they need strong regions. And that's where I think also collectively, but in particular also Africa, needs and the region needs to take its responsibility vis-à-vis Burundi, vis-à-vis DRC, and so on. The last point is, of course, the most difficult one. What are you doing, Geert Laporte? What we can do better? No, I think there are three elements where we want to focus upon. It's the private sector, a real, genuine economic diplomacy, where we are still working what that would all entail. But I think the notion that this should be really in the heart of our external relations, and in particular external relations with Africa, is clear. Secondly, bridging better and bringing better in the internal and external policies of the European Union, energy, climate change, research. There also, in particular, Africa should be a big, beneficiary of this. And finally, and that's maybe the overall approach, really building much more on shared interests. It sets a completely other tone of a relationship. I think it's very much sound when two partners have a shared interest, and I think that would help in looking forward.
Can I just ask you very quickly, how valuable a partner is the African Union? Is the African Union doing things on many of these issues that we've talked about that you think are worth partnering with?
The African Union.
Give me a good answer, not a diplomatic answer.
No, it's not a diplomatic answer. I was the first EU special representative to the African Union.
I know, that's why I asked
you. So I remain a staunch supporter of the EU, and it's probably the best thing that had happened to the African continent, to change from to the African Union in 2003. But it is clear that the organization is somewhat struggling to implement its mandate, which, of course, is not comparable to a supranational European Commission, European Union to a certain extent. But I think we would like to see African members of the African Union taking much more ownership of their own organization and realizing that integration, not only at regional level but also at continental level, is key for development of the continent. And in one way or another, that passes through the EU. And we are working, in particular in the peace and security sector, extremely closely together. It is indispensable. And it's the EU that should become much more the stronger voice of the continent. Mm-hmm. But that depends on its own members,
absolutely,
more than on us.
Right, thank you. Heike, if I could have, we could have your insights.
Yes, from my side, I would also say when we talk about what could the EU do better, I would also include that the EIB, as the EU bank, we ourselves try also to do things differently and better than we did it in the past. And I would say, so what we are trying to do with this idea of Boost Africa is really to work differently compared to the past. And to really intervene in a space where we haven't been, and where actually nobody of the IFIs currently is intervening because it's too risky. I mean, let's face it, financing entrepreneurship at its very, very start is the most risky business for any bank in the world, be it in Europe or in Africa. So we are here building on our experience, which we have under the European Investment Fund, subsidiary of the bank, where we are doing that already partially in Europe. But then also, secondly, really integrating, and that, I mean, it has been mentioned several times, but we strongly believe in that, a win-win partnership between Europe and Africa and a win-win partnership between European and African entrepreneurs, because we consider that there is a lot of win-win between the two.
How do you do that between cross the fertilization? Entrepreneurs?
Well, we have done a first experience last year with a first conference which we organized, the EIB Africa Day, which we organized together with the Luxembourgish EU presidency last year in July, and where we wanted to change from the traditional setup of investment conferences for Africa, where people like me, for example, would sit on a panel and tell you all kinds of miracles what we can do, but to have the entrepreneurs actually sitting on the panels, and we sit in the audience and listen and learn from them. And we tried really to mobilize European investors who have who are active in Africa, and on the other hand, also African entrepreneurs who go who are on the point of getting international. And it was most amazing. And to invite also in the audience European and African CEOs and CFOs. So nothing against consultants, but we didn't want to have consultants in the room. We really wanted to have create a platform, a matching platform for entrepreneurs from both continents. And it was most amazing because we were totally oversubscribed. In the beginning, everybody was very skeptical that that people would come to Luxembourg. And in the end, it was a big success and everybody said, please do it again. And so we said, if it is a success, we do it again. And we plan to do that actually this year in November, but this time in Africa. Together with the African Development Bank, we plan to do that on the date should be the 21st of November in Abidjan. And so because we think also if we do it in Africa, it will allow many more African entrepreneurs to come there. And we would also try to scale it slightly bigger than what we saw last year.
So you invited Dan already?
Sorry?
Have you invited Dan?
Not yet, but he will be definitely on my list.
Any other points you want to make, Heike?
Well, probably also for the matching process, because we were talking about joint ventures. I think this is extremely important. We are doing a lot of workshops together with European business associations who have interested companies who are interested in Africa. So be it the European African Business Association in Germany or in France. So we go around the European capitals. We do also do that from time to time in our headquarters. We see that there is a need, and that's what we have integrated, or we intend to integrate in the Boost Africa concept, is to have also an accelerator, an international accelerator, so to help this matching process to bring European and African companies together.
Right. Dan, you had a very quick one? Yeah, quick, and then Rotime.
Yeah. I just wanted to, now that we're talking about peace, particularly in Africa, there are two things that are actually critical for peace purposes. Number one is employment, for sure, and job creation, wealth creation. But number two is housing. Now, Singapore has used this very, very, very well. Now, more than 90% of Singaporeans are housed. That brings in ownership. It brings in stakeholder engagement. And so whoever is housed has a better motivation to make sure that there is peace around him and around her and security. Now, we need to look at that for Africa as well. One of the biggest problems we have in Africa is that we have no housing. In Kenya, for example, more than 95% of the population do not own their own homes. They live in rental property and so on. People have no ownership. This must be looked at, even from the partnership that we are talking with the European Investment Bank. Not just the funding for the development of the houses, but also funding for how people afford to buy those houses.
Right. Thank you very much for making that point. Rotimi, please.
I also wanted to jump in on the question of the African Union and their role in all of this. We're beginning to see, again, more demand for accountability from the African Union. And if you recall, during the Ebola crisis, the African Union mobilized African private sector to raise, I think, about $100 million to support the countries that were plagued by Ebola, Liberia, and the other two countries that were plagued by Ebola. So the African private sector mobilized and raised resources and were able to send health workers into these countries. And this was a good success story, Africans helping Africans within the continent. And to prevent violence, like that, like everybody else has also mentioned, we need quality education and skills across the continent. We're seeing a good wave of education, but there's a little focus on the quality of such education. We have in several African countries where people have the basic education, they've done 12 years of schooling, but they don't have enough cognitive skills. They also cannot read and write properly. We also need vocational skills education in several African countries. Last also is I want to talk about is the complete value chain. You have a lot of African countries producing agriculture produce for export. In Western Africa, you have a number of countries producing cocoa, and there is no single chocolate companies in many of these countries. You have chocolate companies here in Belgium, in Switzerland, and many of these farmers have not even tasted chocolate before. They've never seen it. They don't know how it looks like. They only know we produce cocoa. They don't use it there, they export. And so we want the entire value chain to remain in Africa. That way it creates jobs not only for the farmers, it creates jobs for the engineers, for the marketers, and for the entire value chain across board.
Thank you very much. It's very interesting. I had chocolate from Vietnam the other day. So there is a great potential in Africa, of course, for making that. So thank you for making the point on global value chains as well. Thank you very much indeed. I don't think we have time for any more questions, but I would like to say thank you very much to our panelists. I think we've had a very stimulating day, but I would also like to say it's been a very sobering day. We've looked at the potential that exists in the MENA region and in Africa, the youth dividend that's there, the civil society, strength and resilience of a civil society that's gone through many, many challenges but come out of it stronger, I believe, the economic potential, the talent, the skills of this region, but also the many, many challenges that we face. I mean, we in Europe face them as well. The challenge is having the right economic policies, regional integration being one of them, lower barriers, better regulation, good governance. We talked about corruption, elite, crony capitalism, and the rest. I think the overall sentiment was well expressed by Alexander De Croo when he was very balanced. He said, when I look at Africa, I do see an Africa rising. So thank you very much indeed. Please join me in showing our appreciation of the panelists, and hope to see you again next year when we'll be talking of a brighter MENA and Africa region.